Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 1st, 2011. We are not joking. Really, seriously, no jokes here. It has been a year since Congress passed the landmark Health Care Reform Act. Despite its promises, lots of Americans remain un- or underinsured.
It makes you feel like you're not valued, like you're less than, like you're not a whole or complete person.
And what do food and money have in common? A lot.
People often feel like they can't get enough, and they can't get enough of the food they really want. They can't get enough of the things they really want. They can't get enough money.
I'm hungry and I want to buy something. We'll hear why. Plus, social media's demands on your self-image.
At this point, I'm more concerned about how old I look. How am I supposed to find a job looking like I'm auditioning for the role of somebody's mother in a gritty crime drama?
LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, do you have a good look for the job hunt? Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
You work hard to be responsible for your finances. Your reward should be that you get better treatment from the banking industry than the financial laggards. But for a good chunk of the housing boom, that was not the case, at least when it came to mortgage brokers. So as of this week, they're facing some new rules from the Federal Reserve. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is here with the details. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Tess.
I guess we should probably start by explaining what exactly a mortgage broker does.
Yes, we should. So let's say I'm going to buy a house.
Oh, very exciting.
Very exciting. I can go to a bank or I can go to a mortgage broker. And the broker works with a number of different lenders and is supposed to sort through my options for me, sort of like a middleman.
Right.
Of course, the broker gets a commission. The broker isn't doing this for free. In theory, Tess, the broker should always give me the best deal. But during the housing bubble, some brokers steered consumers to loans that gave the brokers the highest commissions. And these tended to be the most expensive loans.
So they would be a higher interest rate, usually.
There would be a higher interest rate. Yeah. The subprime loans, everybody remembers.
Right.
Nick Retsinas teaches real estate at Harvard, and he told me how it worked.
There were brokers who were just selling loans like they were selling widgets. And I think this rule is a reaction to that and saying, hey, from this point forward, we have to find loans that have a bias toward favoring the consumer, not the lender.
But Tess, Retsinas stressed that not all brokers did this, and there are some honest brokers out there.
Of course, there are always bad apples that spoil the bunch. But what is this new law supposed to do to keep all of them honest?
That's the tricky question here. It would require all brokers to steer borrowers to the loans that would give the consumers the best deal. But Tess, it's not clear how this would be enforced. I mean, basically, the rule tells brokers to ignore the profit motive, you know, just do this for free. And of course, they don't like that idea. They say they have to make a buck. Chris Mayer says they may have a point. He teaches real estate at Columbia Business School. And Mayer says there's really no way to know if brokers are actually offering borrowers the best deal. And they can find ways around these new rules, maybe by tweaking an expensive loan so it seems like that loan is the only one that meets a borrower's needs.
What a smart salesperson will do is change the attributes of one of those products a little bit and present them in a way to consumers that allow the consumers to choose the one that is more profitable for the broker.
Now, Nancy, obviously the brokers are not in favor of this. And you know, one of the arguments that I've heard is that this is going to mean that some brokers will leave the business and that it could get just plain more expensive for the consumer.
Yeah, and actually, Nick Retsinas of Harvard made those points when I talked to him. Some brokers might quit the business because of these new rules or decide they're just going to sell loans from one bank, just work with one bank. That would mean more concentration in the loan business, higher prices for loans. And Retsinas still likes the new rules, but he also says we may have to pay a little more for our loans because of that protection.
All right. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joining us from our Washington Bureau. Thanks so much, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Don't go. Last week, we aired a special co-production with the New York Times called Money Through the Ages. We profiled people from their teens to their 70s and explored the financial issues facing each of those decades. The response was overwhelming. So we asked Ron Lieber of the New York Times to join us again to talk about some of the reaction. Hey, Ron, glad to have you back.
Good to be back.
So certainly this series seemed to have touched a nerve with quite a few readers and listeners. And for the most part, what I gathered was that a lot of people had epiphanies that said, oh, my goodness, my finances are not in really great shape.
Right. Well, part of the point of the exercise here was to try and help people recognize themselves in sort of the case studies of others, and then hopefully to listen to some of the advice that the gurus were offering up to try and sort of put them on the straight and narrow again.
And certainly that was the case, even just beginning with our teenager who you profiled, and a lot of folks saying, you know what, I'm either in that same situation or I am now looking back at a decision that I made that has saddled me with a whole lot of debt.
It's true. Let me tell you about Jim from Chicago who mentioned this in a comment on our Bucks blog. He said, you know, he graduated with nearly $70,000 in debt and he has a $36,000 salary. And he's wondering now if he'll ever be able to save enough to purchase property. That gets at two things, right? The first one is a ratio. There's a kind of an evolving rule of thumb that says don't end up with more debt than the salary you expect to earn in your first year.
Right.
He has basically doubled his salary in debt. It's making things very tough for him. The other thing that he gets at, and this is very sad, is that, you know, when you saddle yourself with a fair bit of student debt, it closes off other financial options to you, or it delays them until much later on, i.e. after, you know, when everyone around you is doing it. And, you know, he's worried whether he'll ever be able to set enough money aside to have a down payment to be a homeowner if he so chooses.
And we also got quite a bit of reaction to the gay couple that we profiled in their 30s. David Kent wrote to us from Worcester, Massachusetts, thanking us for featuring a gay couple who's raising children and for talking about what he called the unfair financial hardships that many couples like them face because of legalized discrimination against them.
To my mind, this is one of the great civil rights issues of our time. And one way to frame it that doesn't, and it doesn't get framed this way very often, is to think about it just in terms of the things that you can or cannot do economically, the things that you can or cannot do personal finance-wise, mm-hmm. or the things that get complicated because you don't have the right to marry or your marriage is not recognized by the federal government. And it turns out that on the whole, it often costs you more, and sometimes it's much more over a lifetime.
I also noticed that there was quite a bit of tut-tutting that went on as people heard these stories and said, look, you know, they should have been a little more responsible and they should have thought about their futures. I did.
Yep. Laura from Philadelphia. It is striking that so many of these people have lived beyond their means and spent money they didn't have. If we feel sorry for these people and bail them out, we punish the prudent to benefit the profligate.
And that's something we've been hearing a lot over the last couple of years.
I guess the flip side is it's true that there are many people who had too much access to credit and took too much advantage of it than they probably should have. But what we're not hearing about is the people who, you know, were happy that they took on $40,000 or $50,000 in student loan debt because it got them to a school that made a difference in their life. Or the people who were able to use the credit card, you know, to stave off a personal bankruptcy because they had a medical issue and they had no coverage. And they're sure glad that they had that available to them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not to say that, you know, there aren't all sorts of people who are irresponsible. But, you know, we don't hear as much about how loans made people's lives better. And they do, in fact, work that way sometimes.
Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for The New York Times. And we've been talking about our Money Through the Ages series that we presented about a week ago. Ron, thanks so much for coming in again.
Always good to be here.
Far and away, the story that drew the most reaction was our profile of 70-year-old Susanna Wilson, who basically saved nothing for her retirement years. Dozens of you wrote to us and posted on Facebook that you wanted to help. And Wilson tells us she has been deluged by requests for the dresses she makes.
Since the story aired, I've just had lots and lots of emails and lots of phone calls about finding dresses. And I worried about how I was ever going to get any work done with all this going on. But I finally just calmed down, and my friend said, come on, just enjoy this. And so I am enjoying it.
But if Wilson's original story was an abject lesson in preparing for the future, what's happened to her in the past week offers another one. Financial planner Elizabeth Rutter Bear is back with us. We paired her with Wilson in last week's piece, and they've been in touch since then. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks very much, Tess.
I suppose the very first thing we should do is acknowledge this is a wonderful thing to have happen for Susanna, all these offers of help.
Yes, with some limits on that, but yes.
Well, let's talk about those limits. I know that you and Susanna have had a back and forth about some cautionary tales that you've shared with her, and my guess is that these are going to be fairly universal.
I would think so. When people come to you with opportunities, you always want to take a jaundiced look to see who's getting paid and what's in it for everybody. She's getting phone calls and emails, and some of them aren't very nice, as she would say. Some of them are pretty ugly, actually. But some of them are offering her opportunities, and my advice to her was that we don't make any financial commitments, don't give anybody any money, don't put yourself in any kind of a liable situation until you can see what you're dealing with. My biggest concern for Susanna from the beginning has been not current income. The issue is debt and getting out of it and getting onto a reasonable spending situation. And so while there's opportunities for selling garments, these are short-term, small fixes to a long-term, larger problem.
And of course, you know, I think we've all heard stories about how publicity for someone has in turn put them out of business because they couldn't keep up with the demand for their product.
Correct.
But then they needed the publicity in order to get business.
That's why people have business plans.
Yeah.
You really have to take a critical eye to what the potential is. Maybe get an advisor. Many chambers of commerce have business advisors who sometimes don't charge to help somebody maybe start a small business and to get a business plan put together that's realistic. Things can sound wonderful when they're first presented by somebody who really has their own interests, perhaps, at heart more than yours. So lots of research and homework before any commitments are made.
Beth Bear, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Tess.
Elizabeth Rutter Bear is a certified financial planner in Lansing, Michigan.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
And it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is Kathy Kristoff from Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Tess. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. I wanted to talk to you about something that you wrote recently in the wake of the disaster in Japan, which is earthquake insurance. And you had a pretty comprehensive look at what we need, particularly here in California. And I suppose it's possible anywhere in the world that this could happen. So give us a rundown.
The main thing people need to realize is that earthquake insurance is got much higher deductibles and much bigger exclusions than your typical policy. So you're smartest to do all of the things around your house that will make it more earthquake-proof, I should say. Mm. And so what you should be doing is making sure that your home is strapped to the foundation, bolted. You know, all the earthquake retrofitting is going to cost you a lot less than damages if you ever have them. So,
what about, is there any general caveat within earthquake policies that will get you money to find another place to live if your house has to undergo serious reconstruction?
It's incredibly limited.
Yeah.
I mean, with fire insurance, they will pay whatever it costs to get you in a house of equal value. With earthquake insurance, you actually pick your amount that you're going to pay for, and it could be $1,500. That's what they call loss of use. It's a very limited amount that they will allow you to buy for loss of use.
Wow.
They basically expect you to live with a relative. You know, it's just, yeah, it's not, this is very limited coverage. Like I said, I think that the best idea is to look at your house and see what your risks are and try and mitigate those risks without the coverage. And then if you need the coverage, if you want that security in addition, then yes, buy it. But it's expensive and limited.
Well, on that note, let's go ahead and head to the phones. And Heather is with us from Redwood City, California. Hi, Heather.
Hello.
So what do you have earthquake insurance up there?
I would assume so. In fact, we were just talking about earthquake temps last night, so it's really funny that you mentioned that.
Well, I think the key there is that you said, I would assume so, but yeah. Isn't that something you might want to know?
Yeah, it would be. My boyfriend just bought a house, and I'm pretty sure he has some earthquake insurance of some sort, but
yeah. Yeah,
it's a great question. So.
Kathy, where would be the place to look for that?
Your insurer would have offered it to you.
Okay.
They're required by law to offer it to you every couple of years, certainly when you buy a new policy and any time, I guess, every 2 years after you or when you're renewing.
Okay. All right. So, Heather, what do you do up there in Redwood City?
I am a graduate student in the humanities.
Oh, what are you going to do with that?
Well, that's a great question.
Uh-oh. Well, I hope you didn't take out, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in student loans for a degree you don't know what you're going to do with.
I didn't, which is very
good Excellent.
News. Excellent. Yes.
Excellent.
No, that part is okay. But actually, I'm calling about something that's much more long-term. I have a retirement question.
Okay. For you?
No, not for me. For my mom.
So, ah.
I'm 29 years old, and I have a sister who's a few years younger than I am, and we've been talking a lot about my mom's retirement lately.
How old is she?
She's 58.
Okay.
So she's not really approaching, like, a mandatory retirement age, but she's always had this mentality, and she's actually said frequently, I'm just going to have to work until I drop dead, because, you know, she feels like she can't afford to retire.
Kathy, I don't think that's the first time we've ever heard that.
Yeah, well, certainly not the first time that I've heard it.
Right.
But to be perfectly honest, we're getting a little bit more worried about this situation overall, because partly we don't want her to have to work until she drops dead. And as our friends' parents start to retire, we realize that this is something that people actually do.
Have you talked to your mom about it?
Well, my sister and I have, a couple of years ago, encouraged her to open up a Roth IRA, which she did. But my impression right now is that I actually have more retirement savings at 29 than my mom has.
But you say you have an impression. Have you not asked her directly?
Well, we didn't talk about money growing up at all. And now that I think she's cognizant of the fact that it is really an issue, she's mentioned that funding her Roth is something that she sees as being an extra. So ultimately, my question is there anything that my sister and I can do to contribute to my mother's either retirement or some sort of long-term care situation?
Okay, well, Kathy, first of all, I think before they even approach that question, they're going to have to find out from Mom, A, if she needs help, and B, if she wants it.
Well, yeah, I think that whole communication thing, even if your family hasn't traditionally talked much about money, you need to start now and just say, hey, Mom, you know, we want to make sure that you have the best care available. So we need to know where you stand now and what we can do to help.
Right.
And then, you know, maybe what it is that you and your sister fund your mom's Roth IRA. If she can't afford to fund it.
Right.
But as Tess mentioned, you really need to kind of know where she stands. And
yeah, we know she needs help. So
Heather, are you in a position to do that kind of help for your mom?
Well, not... So I do have a Roth IRA that I max out every year. And actually, part of my motivation for opening that was to encourage my mom to open one as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is, it might sound sweet, but we know that at some point, probably in the next 20 years, when we'll be wanting to have families and, you know, and to be saving for our own retirements, that my mom's care is most likely going to come up as a major financial issue.
Right.
And so we are concerned for her, but in the long term, we also know that this is going to be our issue as much as it is hers.
Well, you need to find out exactly where she is and where her sources of income might be coming from. Also, find out if she has any sort of pension and whether she has equity in her home. Create kind of a plan. Figure out how much she needs to spend every month, where the money is going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
You can strategize over when to take certain assets. Like if you delay getting Social Security, you get more every month. Can she work until she's 70?
Right.
If she works until she's 70, all of a sudden the amount that she could get from Social Security increases by like 75%.
Right. She has every intention of working until she's 70. There's no question about that.
Well, then she can potentially get, you know, a lot more money from Social Security. So, and in her case, just from what you're saying,
yeah,
I think Social Security is going to be the key element in her retirement planning right now.
Yeah, I'm afraid that it will be.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's not terrible.
That's not unusual.
Yeah. And that's what Social Security was for.
Right.
You just need to get a handle on how much or how little you need to worry.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that probably what you'll want to do at some point, if she's got a home and equity, she'll probably want to do a reverse mortgage.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably where you're going to be going. What do you think, Tess?
Absolutely. And the one caution, of course, that we would add on the reverse mortgage is that you need to do some research and find a reputable company doing that doesn't have sky-high fees. But there are some out there, so that just requires a little homework.
Right. Yeah.
Well, good All right, luck. Heather.
Okay. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, let's go next to Jay, and he is in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Tess. Hey, Kathy.
Hey, how have you been doing there in New Jersey? Are you thawing out yet?
We thaw out, we warm up. We thaw out, we warm up. It's not like California.
Well, no, indeed, it is not. What do you do there?
I'm actually a political consultant. I do new media stuff for campaigns and for causes.
Good for you. What's your favorite cause?
If I tell you, then that would expose NPR's left-wing bias. Probably gay rights, gay equality. But, you know, I'm also into a lot of mainstream causes as well, including just a real lack of fiscal know-how. So my New Year's resolution for 2011 was fiscal fitness related. Specifically, it was getting my FICO score up.
Good. What is it? What was it at the beginning of the year?
It was 643.
Okay. Not great.
No, not great. For a long time, I had a defaulted student loan.
That would do it.
Yep. Which I was midway through getting out of default, which is a 6 to 9 month process, as y'all know, when unfortunately my mother died unexpectedly.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thanks, Tess. She was really a great role model for a really good way to live financially. And so it's kind of hard because the one person that would be sort of helping me through these phases of my life, of my transition to proper adulthood, obviously is not here anymore. So
yeah.
I guess like every American, I call up a radio show or a talk show.
Did you guys talk about money?
We talked about it a lot. And actually, she was the one who encouraged me to work on getting it out of default. I reached out to the Department of Education after all that trepidation and all those years, and it was really, it was really easy. They were really nice and flexible. And I don't know, it was just a real relief. So I knew I was on the right track. And, you know, you lose your mother and it's all very, very new. And I mean, I know that people get insurance and they inherit stuff, but I never knew what was the time frame of all that. So when I got a life insurance payout check, which I split the amount with my brother, it sort of arrived unexpectedly. And it was roughly the same amount as what I owed the student loans.
Oh, wow. I think your mom was planning for you.
You know, I was listening to your last caller, and it was so touching. I mean, you hear about these kind of cross-generational, you know, ways that we look out for our kinfolk, and it really is very sweet because I think your last caller sort of really embodied a lot of the spirit of my late mother, which was nice to hear.
Yeah.
I basically turned around and paid off the student loan almost without even thinking about it. So I get the paid in full letter about a week ago. And I guess my question is, do they pick up on the good things that I do randomly, or do I need to sort of lobby on my behalf to them?
Yeah, no, you actually don't need to lobby, Fair Isaac. That's a great thing. You actually just need to act. You need to be responsible with your credit. And every time you act responsibly, you make your mortgage, you know, pay a credit card, all that stuff will slowly but surely increase your credit score. In a month or so, just check that it's recorded on your credit report that this debt has been paid in full. And if it hasn't been, then call them and see what you need to do in order to get it reported on your credit report.
Well, I kind of feel obliged to share how easy the process was. You know, you sort of get over your emotional thing. And believe it or not, it was a really decent customer service experience for me.
Good. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that people don't realize is when you're trying to pay your debts, your debtors are really pretty accommodating because they actually like that sincerity.
Definitely. Thank you so much, ladies, for helping me to remember a story about her and also, you know, figuring out what to do for myself.
Thanks for the call, Jane. Good luck.
Bye now.
All right, and finally, we have Neil, and he is right here in Los Angeles, California. Hi, Neil.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. What do you do here in L.A.?
I am a consultant in software.
Well, you know, our first couple of calls here were about families and money.
Well, that's an interesting thing that you mentioned that, because that's exactly what was on my mind when I wanted to contact you.
Wonderful. Well, tell us a little bit about what you're calling about.
The topic that I wanted to ask about was one of the best ways to handle repaying a loan that is within a family.
Ah, good
one.
And
I'm thinking this actually might be something growing as a small trend in the future, and it's getting help starting to buy a home from help from parents or from siblings. But then comes the real question, after some time, to repay back that loan. So the situation I'm in, several years ago, I purchased a home, and I got some help from the parents. We actually split the title down three ways. That was one way to get 20% together. Shortly after buying the house, I started college.
Wait, you bought a house before you went to school?
Well, there was a change in career direction, and it prompted me to want to switch directions, but didn't want to let go of the home. So rented out the house. The rent was able to cover the mortgage expenses, but now I'm in a position where I could talk to them about trying to repay the gift that they set out for me. It was under the understanding that when I was able to do that, that we would get to this discussion and we could pay back the difference. Now, of course,
so when you say an understanding, do you have paperwork?
No, just verbal.
So you guys never talked about how this loan was going to be repaid when it was initially made?
That's right.
See, this is a typical thing with loans between family members, is they're so informal that it actually makes it kind of awkward when you get to the point of repayment. And, you know, I guess I think that the best thing to do with your folks is to give them options and say, okay, so mom and dad, I'm now in this spot where I can repay the loan and we can do it all these different ways. If you're planning to stay or keep the home, do you want me to pay you back with interest and we'll calculate it at, you know, whatever the mortgage interest rate is? Do you want me to wait until I sell the home and then give you a percentage of the profits?
So let's take the scenario that I'd like to keep the house because now that I'm done with school, I want to move back into it.
Good.
What we don't know is that given the interval of time, how do we come up with some sort of value for what the loan amount, that principal, has now grown into?
That is actually easier to do than you'd imagine.
Really? I'd love to hear how.
You go to bankrate.com, look up calculators, and their simple savings calculator. Put in the amount of the deposit or down payment that your parents lent you and an interest rate. Put in zero for additional monthly payments, and it will come up with a number. It might be, unfortunately, more than you're anticipating, but
again, that's something you can talk to them about.
Right.
All right. Got a couple suggestions there. I appreciate your time.
All right. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or send us an email. You can do that at the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Bob Tedrow, and we're sitting in my showroom in my music store in Homewood, Alabama. I have a music store. I build musical instruments, specifically concertinas, squeeze boxes. I have various credit cards, UPS cards, my registration. I have the key to my shop, so I don't have to lose it. No, I don't. I guess I lost it. Wonder where that is. That's gone. Driver's license, a little bit of money. I see here something I've had in the wallet for a while. This Hungarian lady showed me how to fold a dollar bill so that it looks like a shirt. She came to visit the shop. I speak about 50 words of Hungarian, none of them useful, except for I like beer and hello and thank you and that sort of thing. And she came into the shop. She sold me an accordion. And before she left, she asked if I had grandchildren and would I like to see how to make a shirt out of a dollar bill. And I said, certainly, I would love to. It has sleeves. It has a collar. It has jewelry. It has a little necklace on it, and I've kept it in my wallet for years and years. She showed me how to do it. I promptly forgot, but I did save this nice little piece of artwork to show my grandchildren one day.
I could not tell you the number of times we've compared budgeting to dieting on this program. And a new book says it's no accident that our attitudes and feelings about food and money are connected. Whether it's self-deprivation, excess, or shame, Janine Roth says it's all of a piece. Her book is Lost and Found, Unexpected Revelations About Food and Money. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
You make the argument that how we eat and how we spend money are directly related to how we feel about ourselves. I think that's understandable, but draw the line for us from what we eat to how we spend our money.
People often feel like they can't get enough, and they can't get enough of the food they really want. They can't get enough of the things they really want. They can't get enough money. There's this feeling of not enough, not enough, not enough, and not allowing yourself to have what you have. There's also another thing that I talk about called rationalizing. When we rationalize that it's okay to eat this when I'm standing at the stove, it's okay to eat this if it's off my kid's plate.
And the money corollary there?
If it's on sale, it doesn't count.
Right, of course. Is this hardwired into us? Is this biological?
Well, I don't think it's biological. It's about what's going on that we're using food and money to deal with, to, you know, another word that people are using these days, to medicate ourselves. We use it as a drug. I say we use them to change the channel on what's going on in our minds and our lives.
I want to talk to you about the catalyst for this book, which was your own experience going through a big news story from a couple of years ago. You were a Madoff victim, Bernie Madoff.
Yes, I was. I had a good friend who had been invested, whose father knew Madoff and had been invested with him for 30 years. And he invited some of his friends into it.
And you lost your entire life savings?
Everything. 30 years of life savings gone, and it was, as you can imagine, terrifying and shocking, and I went through a period of huge shame and guilt, remorse, terror. I wasn't actually sure how my husband and I were going to make it through, how we were going to live, if we were going to be able to stay in our house. It was pretty horrifying.
Yeah, I cannot imagine. There are thousands of people who were in that same situation as well, who all, I'm sure, took different lessons from that. But what were some of the revelations that now have come into this book out of what happened to you?
One of the things that I learned almost immediately, and this was more survival-based for me, I had to figure out in those first few days and weeks how to bring myself back, really, from the terror. And so I started focusing on what I did have, not what I didn't have, on what I could find, which is why I called the book Lost and Found. I started feeling so much better by realizing there was sufficiency that I actually had been ignoring for many, many years.
Well, you know, we were having some fun at the start of the conversation, and you do offer some fun advice on how we can have a better relationship with money and perhaps also with food. Want to share a few of those with us?
People are loaded with great advice with both food and money.
Yep.
Everybody has heard what to do, how to do it, where to invest, why to invest. I had been hearing that for years. I mean,
on this very show.
That's right. From you, Tess. You give great advice. And I love listening to you, except I'd hear you and I'd think, that sounds great. And then I wouldn't do any of it.
Yep.
And so that's what people do with food. We're loaded with advice. We don't follow it. And so what I really want people to do, number one, being interested in why I'm not following the advice. Because unless you understand why you're not following all the advice you're given, then all the good advice in the world doesn't do anything. once you realize that there's something going on with your relationship with money and food, then you can actually listen to fabulous financial advice.
Janine Roth is the author of Lost and Found, Unexpected Revelations About Food and Money. Janine, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much, Tess.
And you can read more on our big book blog at marketplace.org. The healthcare reform law recently marked its first birthday. Most of its big changes don't go into effect until it turns 4 in 2014. Until then, millions of Americans continue to go without health insurance coverage. Sarah Varney caught up with three people navigating the system here in California. First, a woman who works as a massage therapist and finds herself priced out of the insurance market.
My name is Cindy Lundy. I'm 48 years old in May, and I live in Hayward, California. I've checked into it, and if I can find an affordable monthly payment, typically the deductible is astronomical to the point where you couldn't afford to go to the doctor. It's too much. The last time I had insurance was like 2004 when I worked for club sport. It makes you feel like you're not valued, like you're less than, like you're not a whole or complete person. I had one health issue that really scared me quite a bit. I was sitting on my couch and I felt like the room was spinning. I had lost my eyesight completely in the right eye for about 45 minutes. And when I finally got it back, my head hurt so bad. And since I had no health insurance, I never had it checked out. When I talked about it later with a couple of different physicians, they talked to me about like a really, that could have been a really small stroke. I go to a clinic for people such as myself who are, you know, self-employed or just don't have, you know, the resources to purchase health insurance. It's Access Health in Pleasanton here. So I've been able to go there, make appointments for routine wellness checkups. And they've caught certain things like uncontrolled blood pressure that was actually at a very critical point. And they have been a godsend in my life. Without them, I don't know where I would have been.
One change already in effect is that you cannot be denied coverage because of a pre-existing condition. The law set aside $5 billion for so-called high-risk pools. Here's someone in the deep end of one of those pools.
My name is Brian McCarthy. I'm 27 years old, and I'm currently a student at Sacramento City College in Sacramento, California. About 5 years ago, I jumped off a galloping horse, my sister's horse. I know nothing about horses. And it caused the impact when I landed, caused the blood vessels inside the talus bone in my ankle to be damaged. The bone started to die within my ankle, and this caused a lot of pain. I had a series of surgeries, and at the time I was insured under my mom's state insurance, Blue Cross. And then when I turned 25, I was uninsurable by them. So kind of lost hope during that period. And I'm in my 20s, and I'd like to be able to be more active. And then I heard about the PCIP insurance program, part of the new Obama healthcare plan. And so I jumped on it. And because I had been denied by both Blue Cross and Kaiser as uninsurable due to pre-existing condition. And I happened to be the 187th person that got on this new insurance plan and was able to get the surgery I needed. It's just as good as any PPO. It is a PPO. And there's a large list of providers I can choose from. The coverage is very comprehensive. It does not include dental or vision, but I'm able to get regular checks with my doctor. I'm able to get, it covers prescriptions. And it covered my surgery, and it's $200 a month, with a max out-of-pocket $2,500 a year. Everywhere I go to show that to use the card, whether at the pharmacy or at a doctor's office, it's always the first one they've ever seen. They've never seen it before. So they usually want to check it. They want to see the card, and sometimes they want to make a call because they've never seen it, and they're not sure how to do it. But then they quickly realize, well, it's just like any other PPO, and they deal with it accordingly.
Another option is catastrophic insurance. It comes with a high deductible, sometimes thousands of dollars. You pay for routine care. That's what Paul Martin and Patty Kozlowski chose to do. But even the bare minimum is not cheap.
We started like around 2002 with like regular insurance. And then around 2005, 2006, it got really expensive. Right now we're paying between the two of us $450 and $303. So it's come up to about $750 for the two of us. We, over the years, I have high blood pressure and high cholesterol. So I take two medicines, and I couldn't even tell you when I started that. So we have pre-existing conditions. So it's not like we can shop around. There's always a delay before you just jump in the car and go see your doctor. You figure out, all right, what's this going to cost and what do I think it is and should I worry about it? But cost is absolutely the top concern. What's this going to cost me if I do it? So I would love to be able to see what something is going to cost. And if it's going to cost more because you're going to a specialist, you're going to someone who is, you know, the top of whatever they do, at least you know that. Right now, I feel completely helpless. If they want to raise my rates, what can I do? I have two choices, pay it or don't. You've got your budget and you know how much you can spend each week or each month. And when something like insurance goes up, you have nothing to show for it. It's not like you get better insurance. You look at your budget and say, okay, we're going to have to cut something else out. And so, I mean, we really do think about, well, should we drop it altogether, 20 grand a year put in the bank? It's a gamble, and it's a big gamble. And yeah, so $20,000 a year of our income goes to something that I hope I never have to use, which, again, doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
That was Paul Martin of Sonoma, California. Our healthcare stories were produced by Sarah Varney of Station KQED in San Francisco. The latest unemployment figures provide some hope that the job market is in recovery. Companies added 216,000 positions in March, and the unemployment rate fell to 8.8%. Behind all those numbers are stories of life in this economy. And over the next few months, we're bringing you a series called The Job Chronicles. This week, commentator Cecilia Marcus describes the experience of taking a risk to get a paycheck.
I landed my first real out-of-college job when I was not quite out of college. I was offered a job as a sales and marketing director at a small fine jewelry company right before my final semester. I debated for weeks over whether to take the job and leave my liberal arts major behind. I told myself I was lucky to have a job offer in this economy. I reasoned that school would always be there while this opportunity wouldn't. I wasn't going to be a part of the alarming unemployment statistics for my age group. Almost 6% of recent grads are unemployed. That's double the rate from 2 years ago and the worst it's been since 1983. It was my dream job in a field I was passionate about. Before then, I had floated between internships and short-term marketing stints, but I had always wanted a career in fashion. I imagined sitting in a creatively charged office talking about fashion and style. But the reality didn't quite match up. Yes, I helped with a few designs. I took a business trip to San Francisco. I had a steady paycheck and was earning more than I had in the past. I moved to a bigger apartment, I ate out more than I did when I was in school, and I started thinking about buying a new car. I kept telling myself I should save more, but I had plenty of time. But the thing was, I didn't. I got laid off 3 months into my new job. The company had underestimated the cost of funding my position. When they told me, I was trying so hard to control myself, but my hands shook uncontrollably. But when the shock passed, the odd thing was, I felt a sense of relief. I pushed myself into the job market early because I was afraid I wasn't going to get a job. I still don't know if I'll find work after I graduate, but I realized getting a degree is the most important thing I can do now, and I'm not afraid of being unemployed anymore.
Cecilia Marcus lives in Houston, Texas. Tell us your stories of jobs lost and found. Post on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org/money. Searching for a job is full-time work for lots of Americans right now, and one tool they're using is social media. But if you're a novice at Facebook, Twitter, and other networking sites like LinkedIn, you might encounter some unexpected hurdles from the moment you set up an account. Reporter Deb Monroe sure did.
I think I know what drove Joan Rivers to plastic surgery. She must have had her photo taken for LinkedIn.
It depends on how you manipulate the photo.
That's my daughter, Michaela. As a college sophomore, she's a social media picture pro. She suggested I do what all the younger gals do.
You can do black and white or sepia tone, and it kind of erases all the imperfections on your face. Or you can do a head-on shot and not do anything to the picture, and you kind of look fat and ugly no matter who you are.
At this point, I'm more concerned about how old I look. How am I supposed to find a job looking like I'm auditioning for the role of somebody's mother in a gritty crime drama? The only thing worse than having a not-so-great photo is not having one at all. Krista Canfield is LinkedIn's PR manager.
For instance, before I met you today, it would have been nice to say, oh, is that Deborah who's sitting in the lobby?
And as to my worry about appearing too mature?
The nice thing about it is it's just one picture and it should be a professional headshot.
Wait, did you catch that? LinkedIn recommends a professional headshot. There was a time when only actors had headshots, but social media changed all that, which Canfield says is a good thing.
I think it's more of a leveling the playing field for all professionals.
Now that even us regular worker bees need headshots, it's no surprise that some photographers now market themselves as social media specialists. So I arranged to meet one.
Okay, how about her? She's older.
She's older. She's 63.
Bay Area-based Karina Louise shows me her portfolio.
Here's a photo of another professional woman. She's a bit older. She's about 55. She needed some pictures for her website and for LinkedIn.
Karina says they experimented with angles and light to minimize age lines. The client seemed satisfied with the results in the camera's display panel, but when the actual photos arrived,
I heard some complaints about how old she looked.
Compare that to another older client. In his photo, he doesn't look worried about his crow's feet, the gray around his temples, or that his clothes don't even match.
He was really fun to work with, really easy, confident, happy with how he looked, even though he maybe isn't the stereotypical sort of beautiful man, but attractive man.
And that, says Karina, is the difference between men and women. Generally speaking, men worry less about their photos and as a result often take better pictures. And Karina's noticed another difference too.
Yeah, there's something about with photographing men versus women is men, when they're not smiling, can look confident. Women, when they're not smiling, it's a little bit cold.
So now I have to smile. That means I'll have to whiten my teeth. And for that, I'll need more time. Phew! One more excuse to delay having my photo taken for LinkedIn. In Berkeley, this is Deb Monroe for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, we'll dedicate the show to Uncle Sam's mostest favoritest day.
I think there are some things that there's more value in passing them off to somebody who that's what they do for a living, and taxes is a big one for me. Like, I would never pull my own tooth.
Cue the sobs, the gnashing of teeth, and the rending of garments. It's tax time. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.